Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody, welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnā ka mihi ki te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darumbal Country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. Finally, if you enjoy this potty, please subscribe, comment, like or share on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now, on with the show. Today, we are so lucky to be sitting down with the wonderful Dr. Kate Wiley, who long-time listeners might remember from her first appearance on the podcast way back in season 1, episode 22. But for anyone that's new around here, Dr. Wiley is a GP, the founder of Climate Medicine, and the executive director of Doctors for the Environment Australia. A lot has happened in the world of planetary health since we last spoke with Kate, and this is going to be a jam-packed episode, so let's just get straight into it. Kate, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, good on you, and lovely to see you both again, Ben and Emma. Thank you very much for inviting me along. I'll also acknowledge country. So I live and work on Tandanya on Kaurna Yurta, which is the home Adelaide Plains. Hello in Kaurna to a group is Namani. So Namani to you both, and thanks for having me back to the Lentil Intervention. I'm really excited to be here.
I cannot believe it's been, what, 3.5 years since that last interview, A well-downloaded, well-listened episode. We had you back for a very impactful contribution to our season Christmas. Ending for, and I will touch on that a little later because I want to see where you're at since your little dialogue there. And of course, Emma and I had the absolute privilege of being contributors to your one of your idea conferences a few years ago. But so much has changed for you as well. We were just chatting offline, but let's bring it online now. You were a GP, you're working, you know, you had a job. And now we were just saying what we feel is a dream job doing, you know, advocacy work, but you're paid for it. So tell us, what's been happening the last few years and where you're at with Doctors for
the Environment Australia. Okay, really happy to. So when I first met you, I just started a personal advocacy project, Climate Medicine, where I applied a medical model to climate change. And, you know, my favourite sentence is climate change is a health issue. We need to treat it, because I really believe that once you put the health frame onto climate, you know, it sort of entices or encourages you to treat it like we treat all the other health problems facing humanity. But of course, you know, my day job has always been as a GP. That's been my trade. And, you know, have loved general practice, and general practice is a great privilege. You get to, you know, really have very deep personal connections with people over time, and it's a wonderful profession. However, I've also been involved with Doctors for the Environment. DEA is a not-for-profit group of doctors who fundamentally volunteer their time to do something about health and climate. And, yes, I've been volunteering with DEA for some time now and have had various roles within DEA, and found myself board chair at the beginning of last year when our previous executive director stood aside, and I had this opportunity to, you know, put my hat into the ring to, you know, be employed in the thing that I am most passionate about, which is climate action to protect human health. And, you know, here I am, got the gig, so feeling like a pretty lucky person, actually.
Huge shift away from moving from your GP practice, though, after so many years. Were there any nerves, any butterflies?
Oh, of course. You know, and I think, you know, would have been, if I wasn't nervous, that would have been a problem within itself, you know. You know, big change in my world, big change from general practice, which, you know, that was hard, you know, like walking away from a job I know and love so much, and especially my long-term patients, like some people who have really strong, you know, relationships that you develop over, you know, 15 years of practice. But, and, you know, and then into this new field of being an executive director with, you know, 4 staff and 2,000 volunteer doctors, and trying to, you know, keep us all, you know, working together and in some kind of similar direction. But, you know, we learn by doing, and, you know, I'm really fortunate to have really great people around me who are happy to give me advice when I need it, and, you know, who, yeah, who've been really helpful. And, you know, obviously I'm pretty passionate about it, and I think that goes a long way.
So staying on the theme of what you've been up to, what you're getting up to, before we get stuck into the nitty gritty, you've got a fairly big trek coming up in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
La Rapinta Trek for Health and the Environment. Tell us a little bit about that. Where is La Rapinta? And yeah, why are you doing this? Why are you putting yourself through this?
Well, be good for me. We're doing a trek of La Rapinta. So La Rapinta is not far from Alice Springs, and it's a 5-night trek where we hike every day to firstly have connection to the country up there, and I'm really, really looking forward to that. And hopefully raise some money for DEA in the process. And we're looking for people to, you know, support us by. So it's a bit like it feels a bit like a walkathon to me. It's like how many laps can I do? How many times can I walk up and down Mount Sonda? But yeah, it's basically a way of us showing that at DEA, we really do care about the environment. We want to get out there and, do our best, get a bit fit, and yeah, raise some money in the process.
You might have to be our first ambassador for Athletes for Nature, getting out there and promoting advocacy for our environment.
Well, maybe, Ben, because, you know, the other thing is, you know, sort of segueing now, but, you know, so many of us who are climate aware people, you know, we need our time in nature to kind of ground us, to, you know, to support our mental health, you know, because it's certainly, it's where am I happiest is, you know, where I was today at lunchtime, which is walking in my local park called Mount Anstey Hill, and making sure I'm doing as many ups as possible in anticipation of the 8Ks up that is Mount Sonda, with my dog, you know, and watching the birds and, you know, seeing the odd koala and seeing the odd kangaroo and feeling the beauty of it all.
And just reminding ourselves what we're actually fighting for here, what there is to lose if we don't do our work. This episode will go to air, I think, the day before you start the hike. So for any listeners, is there still time to support your campaign?
Absolutely.
Obviously, we'll put the link in the show notes. Excellent. Good.
Absolutely, there is. And they can always go to our website, dea.org.au, and find a link there to La Rapinta. Absolutely.
Okay, brilliant.
Very appreciated.
Speaking of DEA's work, we're recording this hot on the heels of the annual conference, and the lineup this year looked absolutely fantastic. The theme's very, very applicable to what's happening here in Australia at the moment. There's always a nice little buzz and a burst of motivation after attending a conference like this. So are there any key learnings or highlights that you'd just love to share with our audience?
Yeah, I'd love to. Like, it really was a great conference too. There was so much energy in the room, and so many people came out of it feeling really motivated to act on climate. Because, you know, we heard, you know, like we always, you know, we heard about the climate science and, you know, the fact that we haven't really got much carbon budget left if we're going to have a 2-degree future, and that, you know, we're pretty much looking at 1.5 already. And, you know, of course, we talked about the heat, you know, and pollution and all the, you know, the big climate health effects that we're pretty familiar with. But rather than sort of lose hope, it's all about active hope. It's all about saying, hey, you know, we still have time to act here as long as we kind of get on and do. And my favourite quote of the whole weekend came from Michael Mann, who's a climate guru out of the US. And it was, it's not game over, it's game on. And I thought, yeah, let's do that. Game on. Let's get into it. You know, we've got, you know, and I sort of think, you know, with health, there's such a great advocacy potential in the health voice of saying, you know, what we're doing to our planet is affecting human health. And let's, you know, protect human health. And, you know, healthcare has advocated for so long in so many ways, you know, like the health professions, our advocacy around smoking, our advocacy around the harms of diet, our advocacy around alcohol and all those sort of unhealthy things. We need to now, let's turn that attention to, you know, the climate crisis, because, you know, what does the World Health Organization tell us? The climate crisis is a health crisis. It's this greatest health problem facing humanity. And I think any health professional has a responsibility to kind of use their voice to do something about it. And yeah, that was the mood of the room. And, you know, we've got some pretty motivated members out there. It's great.
And I suppose just one quick question on that. Will there be any recordings available for purchase for anyone that wasn't able to attend?
Yeah, absolutely. It was recorded by the group at Armchair Medical, and we're just organising that, and we'll get that out as soon as we can. I can probably provide you the link for when this comes on air.
So we're going to talk about some of the advocacy work that you are actively involved with yourself through DEA, but with the theme being building momentum for this conference, what do we need to keep momentum with? Michael Mann, game on. But what are we really, what came out of the conference that sort of reminded people, keep doing what you're doing? What's perhaps their key focus?
Fundamentally, is that fossil fuels are a health hazard. So, when we're burning coal, oil and gas or using it, we are damaging our health in multiple different ways. And so we as DEA are certainly going to continue our momentum in this way. We've got a lot in the wings coming up around advocacy around fossil fuels or a health hazard and a campaign around that. And, sort of harnessing the energy of those in the room. So, the people there, a lot of them are our members. And when you look around DEA, we do lots of different work in lots of different spheres. We've got a sustainable healthcare group that does amazing work around having the health professions practice sustainability. We've got our emissions reduction. We've got a biodiversity group who's really interested in the health impacts of biodiversity loss. And we sort of highlighted some of the different works that, different member groups are doing and realising that, A, we are making a difference by the work that we do, and it's certainly, when we look at all the depth and breadth of what we do and look back over time, DEA's come a long way. Started off around a kitchen table in Adelaide 20 years ago, five doctors going, what are we going to do about this? And so recognising that timeline, it's like, going forward, we keep going. Because not time to give up, just time to recognise the, forward momentum of what we've got, keep that ball rolling, maybe, make it like a, rather than Prometheus pushing the boulder up the hill, let's have the snowball getting bigger as it goes down the hill and we, create positive change.
So DEA have a fantastic range of resources on the website. There's different interest groups that practitioners can be involved with. As you said, you've got your fingers in a lot of different pies here. There's a steward committee. But one of the things that keeps the organisation very busy by the looks of it is your lobbying work to government and industry. There have been quite a number of recent submissions by DEA. So, of course, we won't have time to talk about all of them. But maybe one that we could just touch on here is the submission to Senate regarding the duty of care and intergenerational equity or the Climate Change Amendment Bill. So, Kate, what's that amendment bill all about, firstly, and what are DEA's recommendations or suggestions?
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, the duty of care bill really resonates with us as doctors because, we have a duty of care. That's our core being, is that doctors have a duty of care to look out for the health of their patients. And, what the bill and the Intergenerational Equity Bill asks is for governments to have a duty of care to consider the impacts of fossil fuel projects on children in Australia. And this came out of the Sharma case that was in court a couple of years ago, which you guys, I don't know if you guys are aware of that, but Anjali Sharma and I think it's seven other young children argued to the court that the then Liberal government had a duty of care to consider the health impacts of fossil fuel projects on the health of young people. And at first they won, and it was a really great day, and everybody, they were, young people doing so much for their planet, like such heroes. But unfortunately, the government then appealed and on appeal lost. And so currently now our government does not have a duty of care to consider the well-being of the children of our country. And I find that to be just like shocking. How can that be true? How can our world be this way? And so, DEA is very happy to support the bill. We certainly, recognise too that climate change impacts disproportionately affect young people, and that they are at great risk from the effects of climate, like heat and pollution and smoke, etc. And, you know, all it really asks is that for the current reporting mechanism that the bill has, is to, you know, add considering the health effects on children. It doesn't have to be that onerous either. But, you know, of course it was put forward as a private member's bill and probably won't succeed.
So what's the opportunity to do to in the interim to fill the gap? Because, you know, we often say don't wait for policymakers because that change is not going to come, and if it will, it will be too slow. We need to act ourselves. What can DDA advocate for? I mean, you're advocating for the ultimate, to have a duty of care in place, but until that's going to happen, what do you do instead? How do you bring the awareness? How do you bring the change in other ways?
Yeah, and isn't that always the question? So, you know, a lot of it is around some of the other advocacy work that we do. One of the things we're interested in is health impact assessments. So another thing that we've come up with is that, you know, often when the approvals for new fossil fuel projects like new coal and gas are going through, the health impacts are not necessarily considered. And so, you know, we think they should be. It doesn't seem like such a stretch to us. But again, that's a policy thing. Again, that can be slow. Really, it's about awareness raising. You know, it's about our, you know, all the people in our communities recognising that what's happening now is really, really bad for us. And that's a lot about what our Fossil Fuels Are a Health Hazard campaign is really going to be about, is awareness raising on the health impacts of climate change, which, of course, is caused by burning fossil fuels, the health impacts of the air pollution from, you know, petrol guzzling cars, from, you know, the internal combustion engine, the combustion of fossil fuels, and also the health impacts of plastics, which are mainly made from fossil fuels. And, you know, there's a big problem that is under-recognised and, you know, just, you know, really, really dangerous stuff.
And, I mean, it might not pass, but I saw you on the news, you know, like it gets the word out there. People do talk about it. So that's something.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the more awareness raising, the better, because at some stage there's going to be an election, you know, and that's when, you know, the power of community advocacy is so important, because when do politicians listen most to the voter? Right around voting time, you know, and unfortunately we all know that there's a big sort of, you know, political lobby, that there's powerful people with vested interests walking the halls of Parliament. That certainly happens in Australia. I'm assuming, Ben, that it happens in New Zealand as well. And, you know, around election time is when, you know, people power comes to the fore. And, you know, we need our people to be aware that, you know, what we're doing to our planet is really, really bad for them. And, you know, they should stand up around it. You know, and I know the biggest problem at the moment is cost of living. You know, that's the thing that most people are most concerned about. And fair enough too, you know, we should live in a world where people can afford to feed their kids and, you know, put food, you know, have a living wage. But, you know, what people don't talk about very often is the impacts of climate change on the cost of living and what that means. You know, like food and water insecurity just puts prices up. You know, so a responsible government would absolutely be acting on climate, because that action would reduce costs and therefore improve the well-being of the people.
Look, a time of elections also brings a lot of false promises. So it's that balanced approach. But you raise a valid point, because whenever there's submissions for permits for, say, oil and gas, mining, even construction, these supposed, inverted commas, environmental impacts, sort of surveys or reports attached. But I don't believe there's ever a health impact report or survey attached to it. So I think that's something that perhaps in Australia with a duty of care bill, can bring about, but perhaps, say, companies want to be seen as operating in a more ethical manner. Maybe that's an opportunity for anyone listening to start implementing in their ways of operating is including, and it'll probably be manipulated just like they do with environmental impacts to try and get it across the line, but at least it starts asking the questions and it starts creating the awareness.
Well, it happens a bit, but it happens in a really ad hoc way. And, you know, unfortunately, because Australia is complicated with federal and state, so the rules are different in different states, but the overall thing that basically happens is a health impact assessment may form part of an environmental impact assessment, but only if the proponent asks for one. So there's, you know, any of these big companies having to then ask for one. So that doesn't tend to happen very often. But then when if they do happen, they're not necessarily done by health professionals. So they might be done by engineering firms, which, of course, you know, engineers are very intelligent people and all of that, but they're not trained health professionals. And, you know, DEA's position is basically let's have mandatory health impact assessments done by health professionals. Doesn't sound that hard. Doesn't sound that crazy.
No. There's been quite a bit of lobbying around vehicle emissions. Tell us a little bit about that in terms of why that in particular is so significant.
Well, we know that there's about 11,000 plus deaths in Australia from vehicle emissions now. And, you know, when, you know, the health impacts of pollution from the internal combustion engine are massive. You know, like the World Health Organization says that 99% plus of the world does not have access to clean air. So we're all breathing dirty air all the time. And certainly there's, you know, Australia globally, you know, could be worse, but, you know, certainly we know of people who have died because of air pollution. And in Australia right now, you know, we have, yeah, air pollution deaths that are more than the road toll about 10 times. And we get all the dirty cars, you know, we don't have any decent standards. So car companies are able to ship over to Australia cars that are less fuel efficient, that tend to burn, you know, dirtier, release more nasty gases into the atmosphere. And that affects the health of, you know, us people walking around breathing that stuff in. And, you know, like the health impacts, just to like a quick summary, you know, like it's pretty obvious that car is also bad for your lungs, you know, anyone who's ever cycled behind a bus probably knows that pretty well. But, you know, you breathe it in, impacts on, you know, makes your asthma worse, impacts on your respiratory function, gets into your bloodstream, goes to your heart, causes heart disease, can go to your brain, you know, is associated with neurological decline in elderly people, is associated with delayed neurological development in our children. So you know, reduced milestones for our kids, learning problems in our children. You know, and of course there's the cancers, so lung cancer and all sorts of fun things. Like the health effects are broad and awful, and yet we just all don't even think about it. We just think, oh, yeah, it's fine to have all these cars. I suppose, you know, Australia, we're a pretty car-centric society. You know, and we need to maybe, you know, think about that with our TAM planning, you know, get people off cars and onto bikes and walking.
That sounds too sensible, Kate.
No, Emma. You know, shouldn't be that hard. Actually, someone in the that was this particular point was brought up at the conference, and the person made the point that, you know, in lots of cities in Europe, you won't have cars in the centre of the city. You know, that it'll be basically people walking or people riding bicycles.
Oh, the uproar when it happens here to close one part of a street down or remove one lane.
Yep.
And half the time the council backtracks, or, you know, it's like you say, Australia and New Zealand, very, very, very car-centric societies.
Mm-hmm.
It's the backlash that you get. You know, never mind. You put a bike lane in, there is an increased use of, you know, more bikes, more walkers, more runners, etc. Yet the complaints are there. It's never used. So much money invested. They don't see the big picture, especially the health metrics. Speaking of which, talking about a little bit about pollutions, let's take a bit of a step back and look more globally. Allergens in general, as a result of climate change, not just petrol guzzling cars, but climate change in general, because that's a big focus of the work that you guys do. How are we looking?
Yeah, not great.
Okay.
Yeah, not great. So hard to give you hard numbers to you, Ben, but fundamentally with climate change, we're getting increased risk, like increased incidence and increased severity of asthma and hay fever. And so people that, you know, hadn't really had much asthma before or hadn't had much hay fever before, and now, you know, getting these conditions. And, of course, that's pretty dangerous. Like, let's not forget that asthma can kill people. People die from asthma. Asthma is scary, you know, scary to not be able to breathe. And, yeah, so just another, you know, fun thing about climate change is that our pollens, you know, the dangerous season for pollens is longer, and some of these pollens are more sensitized so that they're, you know, causing more of a reaction in our bodies. And, yeah, hay fever and asthma, just another fun fact from climate.
Speaking of asthma, though, Ventolin inhalers, they have a surprisingly large carbon footprint. Are there environmentally friendly alternatives like the dry powder inhalers that doctors and patients could be considering?
Yeah, absolutely, there are, Emma. So, yeah, Ventolin is, now I might get the number a bit wrong, it's either 26 or 27 kilos of CO2 equivalent per inhaler versus the, so they're your blue, grey kind of puffers.
Can we explain why? Where's that coming from? Where's that?
It's because of it's the type of propellant that's used. So the actual gas that gets the, you know, stuff to come out of the thing into your lungs is a highly potent greenhouse gas. Versus the dry powder inhalers, or what I call click click puffers. So they're the ones that are a cylinder and you go click click on the base of it and breathe it in that way. They're typically less than 1 kilo CO2 equivalent per inhaler. So, like, that is something that any health professional can do. It's as simple as writing a script. And, you know, often the dry powder inhalers are your preventers. So they are medications that will reduce the amount of asthma a person has. So that means that it's sort of safer for the patient. They're less likely to have to rely on Ventolin. Ventolin is a reliever, which means you use Ventolin when you're having asthma symptoms, whereas the preventers prevent you from having asthma symptoms in the first place. So get people on preventers, reduces the need for Ventolin, and has a much lower footprint. There is also a short-acting, you know, drug that's sort of quite equivalent to Ventolin called Bricanyl, which, again, you can have as a dry powder inhaler. Yeah, simple.
So apart from asthma and hay fever and allergens, eczema, we've recently had an episode with Dr. Sally Gillespie discussing some of the mental health impacts on communities due to the increasing rate of climate disasters. But, of course, climate change has a really broad range of hazards when it comes to human health. Extreme heat is likely the big one that we need to talk about firstly in Australia. Heat waves in this country are becoming hotter, longer, more frequent. What does that mean for our health?
Well, you know, heat waves are historically Australia's most deadly natural disaster. And as our planet gets hotter, it's just going to get worse. You know, 2023, hottest year on record. January, Australia had its hottest nighttime temperatures ever. And so, you know, our bodies just are not equipped to cope with all the heat. And we're all at risk of heat-related illness. So there's things like, you know, a lot of people, you know, you just know you feel a bit off on a hot day. I think a lot of people can kind of recognise that. But there is heat exhaustion and heat stress, and, you know, where people can be medically very unwell. And the scariest of them all, which is heat stroke. Heat stroke's a medical emergency. That means your body has run out of all resources to keep itself cool. And, you know, you can basically die within minutes from heat stroke. So pretty, pretty scary stuff. But also on hot days, we're also at increased risk of heart attacks. We're at increased risk of what we, the normal kind of strokes, so cerebrovascular accidents. We're at increased risk of renal failure. So, you know, any time we put pressure on our bodies, you know, it breaks at its weakest link. And so anybody who's got underlying tendencies, people with any chronic illness are at more risk on hot days. And as Sally would have said, you know, the mental health impacts. So we know the hot days increase depression, exacerbations of anxiety and depression. We also see more self-harm on hot days. We see increased suicidal ideation on hot days and during heat waves. We also see increased violence generally and more domestic violence on hot days. So, you know, this is bad news bears, isn't it? Like, it, you know, it, the effects are really, really broad. And of course, you know, some people are more vulnerable. We have a lot of people in Australia living in really hot houses, you know, like rental accommodation or houses without good insulation, who are at high risk of heat-related illness. people living in poverty, you know, like if you can't afford to turn on your aircon, even if you've got one and you can't afford to turn it on, what do you do? You know, and certainly DEA, we've got a good heat health fact sheet. And one of the things we talk about is using a fan. Like a fan up until about 35 degrees of temperature can reduce temperature by about 4 degrees, which is something, certainly better than nothing, and are generally cheaper to run than an air conditioner. The biggest thing is water is your friend. So, you know, get in the bath, get in the shower, put your feet in a bucket of water, you know, wear wet clothes. You know, these things are important because, yeah, as I said, heat waves, they're killers.
Being an ultra marathon runner, the one thing we talk a lot about is the impact of heat, and a lot more events in general, not just trail running, but a lot more events are being impacted by extreme heat, whether they're shortening courses, changing courses, cancelling events altogether. A triathlon event in Northern Hemisphere was cancelled just a month ago. But the issue here is that physical activity is one of the important lifestyle health metrics in terms of combating non-communicable diseases, along with diet and other areas like substance abuse and so on. But physical activity is important.
And important for your mental health too.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. But the inability to exercise when it's that extreme heat will compound a lot of those factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what do you, you know, so what's the response then from your community, Ben? Is it like, we have to sort of do them earlier in the day, or we're going to switch our events to winter, or we're going to, you know, try and sort of get around it in other ways?
For a lot of events as a business, you know, you carry on, but I think as within our community, more immediate community in terms of the runners, we've got to be more serious in terms of how we combat the heat, cooling strategies. There's a fantastic piece of technology out there. I use it and it monitors our core body temperature. It's quite fascinating to see how high my core temperature does go, how often it can go over 39 degrees.
Yeah.
But that for me, using a bit of science, you understand the physiological impacts on the body, and you're going to trajectory downwards. So you've got to look at cooling strategies, but that's all great on paper, because when you're out in exposed country with little wind and in the sun, what is a cooling strategy other than stopping under a rock and trying to slow down your breathing? So the awareness is there, but that's okay. But that's a very few of us that kind of focus on that. But for the majority of the population that go for an easy 30-minute walk or a 3K run around the block, that's part of their mental health routine daily, say, they don't have this technology. They don't have this knowledge.
Plus, I mean, Australia and New Zealand, you know, like we think of ourselves as sporting nations, is deeply ingrained in our communities. And especially, I know, growing up in a rural community, those weekend sports days were so important in terms of
its community
socialization. Exactly.
Yeah. And yet, you know, so, but, you know, there could be some simple choices made there, couldn't there? You know, about when you, what time of day you hold the event and all of that sort of stuff. You know, you see it with kids sport a lot, you know. There they are, it's a 40 degree day and they're out there, you know, playing cricket or whatever in a black jumper. And I think the point to make here too is that, you know, when we think of who's vulnerable to heat, like the very elderly and the very young are the most vulnerable, but healthy people in their 20s are vulnerable too. You know, so people who work outside, tradies certainly have got a lot of heat exposure. And, you know, there was a case in Queensland a couple of months ago as two, you know, guys in their 20s, kind of fit blokey blokes who, you know, had heat-related illness. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, if there's anything that maybe can bring it home to people that what's happening to our planet now is their problem too, that it personally affects us all, maybe, you know, the impact of heat on sporting events is an in.
And look, inequity is also prevalent there, because you look at wealthy private schools, they build these massive permanent structures, you know, that covers three netball courts or whatever it is, and they can still play sport, whereas the schools in low socioeconomic communities, they don't have that funding to do that. So the kids are being exposed to, never mind heat, it could be other elements as well. So that disparity is still there as well, even with schools, even with various communities where
and the impact of that on learning, You know, like you look at some of suburbs where, you know, like where I live in Adelaide, you know, certainly in the, you know, the less well-to-do suburbs, they've got less trees. They're more likely to be in portable rooms that are basically little tin shed hot boxes. Can't, you know, less likely to have air conditioning there. And so what does that mean for the kids inside those rooms? They're going to be fractious, you know, they're going to be grumpy, not going to be able to concentrate on what they're doing. You know, it's, yeah, it's a problem.
So what about the flip side now? A little bit of rain, yay, it's cooling, but then the rain doesn't stop. And before you know it, I think New South Wales has just had it, literally at time of recording, flooding now, storms, cyclones.
Yeah, and that has its own massive mental health problems and physical health problems. You know, we just had the MJA Lancet countdown report released, you know, last month, and one of the big things they highlighted was the huge insurance costs from the 2022 flooding in Australia. 7.168 billion insurance loss and climate related catastrophes. That's a heap of cash. Of course, you know, lots of displacement, you know, people sadly die in floods. And, you know, infectious disease. So we get outbreaks of diarrheal infections. It's a great place for mosquitoes, which means all those sort of mosquito-borne illnesses like, you know, Japanese encephalitis, and, you know, like globally things like cholera and malaria. And food and water insecurity. You know, the water's not drinkable in a flood, or the livestock drowns, or the crops drown. You know, and yeah, people drown and they lose their homes. So yeah, floods are bad too.
And then we've had the rain and then we've got the heat. So we've got the fuel. So the risk of bushfire is considerable as well. So I know climate change doesn't trigger a bushfire per se, but it can definitely make it worse. How do bushfires harm our health?
Well, there's the obvious thing of like the burns themselves and, you know, people dying in fires, which is just terrifying. And just, yeah, really overwhelming. But it's the smoke, Emma. It's the smoke that's the big health risk. So, you know, back in the Black Summer, we had 32. It's about 32, I think, people died from the fires, but more than 400 died from smoke inhalation. So, you know, like when there's a fire, you can smell it. You just can feel it, can't you? And, you know, we get more asthma. We get more heart attacks. We get more people with respiratory illness. And what that means is we get lots more pressure on our hospital system, on our health infrastructure. So, you know, EDs are overwhelmed during heat waves. EGs are overwhelmed during fires because, you know, so many more people are unwell. They front to ED or front to their GP. And so, you know, I think that's another thing to recognise that, you know, we have an overloaded healthcare system. And certainly with climate change, that's putting further stress on that system.
So you've mentioned the medical journal Australia Lancet countdown on health and climate change. What's this countdown? What are we counting down towards? What are we looking at?
Yeah.
And what are some of the key outtakes of the latest release?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, it is till 2030. It started in 2018 in Australia. And they release it every year, and it is a benchmark study where they basically look at all the scientific evidence gathered over that year around health and climate change and look at what the impacts are, how vulnerable we are, how prepared we are, whether or not we're acting or not, and look at, you know, the various things. And so this last one's just come out. The flooding was one of the big things they found. The other thing they found was, which I think you two would be very interested in, is diet-related diseases coming out. So that our high red meat and our high processed meat consumption, plus the fact that we don't eat enough fruit and veg, means that half of the 87,000-odd diet-related deaths in 2021 were from that poor diet. And if we could reduce our red meat consumption, we would save lives that way, but we'd also reduce the carbon intensity of our food because, you know, it's the ruminant animals that, you know, release the, that cause the most, have the highest carbon footprint. So beef, lamb, dairy are our top three. And that's associated also with land use change and the amount of water that they use. So, you know, one of the things, this is the first time the Lancet's really mentioned diet to my memory. They always talk about, you know, the heat and the mental health and the pollution and asthma and all of those things. But yeah, and diet, I think, is there's such a positive out of that, because I think always with climate change, for individuals, it's a pretty overwhelming space. You know, like, it's really, really confronting, isn't it? But here's a thing that everybody can have agency over. Here's a thing that we can all do ourselves and think, okay, I'm helping make a difference by, you know, what I choose to eat. And, you know, and I can be healthier and my planet can be healthier too. You know, win-win.
Do they make a correlation between the diet and resilience to the health hazards? So eating a better diet contributes to a healthier body, which makes you a little bit more resilient to combating the ill effects of pollution, heat impacts, and things like that. I mean, does it draw a little bit of a conclusion around that as well, or not yet?
The study itself doesn't, Ben, but it's a really good point because that we know that the people who are at most really risk of climate-related illness are those with underlying health conditions. So the more we do to keep ourselves healthy, you know, the lower our risk is, and also the better prepared that we can be.
So this year the report, I mean, it looked at 25 indicators. Some are definitely going in the wrong direction. Some are actually tracking in the direction we want, which is a good thing. But the key messages from the report, I mean, are there any worthwhile kind of fleshing out here? Does it all come down to greenhouse gas emissions? We need to, you know, mitigate and adapt more urgently, or what's the key takeaways?
The key takeaways, we need to stop burning coal, oil and gas, otherwise our health is at risk. You know, like, fundamentally, every time it comes back to that. They did this year, you know, have some good news around the National Health and Climate Strategy. So last December, Australia released its first National Health and Climate Strategy, which at least is saying, hey, there is a problem and we need to do something about it. And we are seeing more links with climate and health recorded in the media, which I think is a plus, you know, so at least there's more attention being given to this topic. But, like, you know, it always comes back to the same thing. We've got to phase out coal, oil and gas, got to get out of them and just move, get on with it, you know, and stop kicking the can down the road, which we've been doing for, what, 30 plus years?
DEA have teamed up with the Australian Medical Association for a number of years now, and you're working together to mitigate the severe health impacts of climate change, but also have a goal around transitioning to an environmentally sustainable healthcare sector. Big goal of net zero by 2040. Tell us more about that partnership and the memorandum and, you know, any progress updates.
Yeah, sure. And an interim reduction target of 80% by 2030. So, you know, what we recognise is that the healthcare system carries its own carbon footprint. You know, if healthcare was a country, we'd be the fifth largest emitters in the world. And in Australia, healthcare is about 7% of the nation's carbon footprint. So, you know, the AMA recognises, DEA recognises that, you know, we have a responsibility to do something about that. You know, how can we be advocating for emissions reduction if we're not prepared to clean up our own industry? And, so the National Health and Climate Strategy was part of long-term advocacy goal from DEA and a lot of other climate and health groups. And now we want to see it properly funded, which is its own little moment of cynicism, but, you know, that's there. But DEA provides a lot of sort of guidance around how different health workplaces can, you know, be sustainable. We've got, like, an all-electric hospitals guide. We've got green college guidelines. We've got a number of things that, you know, just show the how. And a lot of it's not that hard. You know, a lot of it's where you get your energy from. Renewables. You know, a lot of it is considering the impact of your clinical care. So one of the things I've always found really interesting is that when we look at healthcare, you know, about 60% of healthcare is good clinical care. And then about 10% of healthcare is harmful care, which is unfortunate and, well, very unfortunate sometimes. And 30% is called low value care, which just doesn't mean it's that bad, but it's not really that good. And if we took away the low value care and the harmful care, we take out 40% of our care, take out 40% of our carbon emissions just by doing good practice. And so, you know, we love that at DEA. We think that's really great. And so that's where things like not ordering unnecessary tests, not ordering unnecessary investigations, not having people on unnecessary medications that they don't really need to be. You know, I really want to caveat, you know, if it's necessary, absolutely we do it, and we always have to put the health of our patients first. But, you know, sometimes, you know, there's things that we can do better there. And, you know, let's look at healthcare benefits. Let's encourage people to have healthy lifestyles, you know, exercise, eat well. That reduces your reliance on the healthcare system, reduces your reliance on medications, etc. Everyone wins.
I think the one thing that really shocked us at the conference that we were part of was the amount of waste that is generated by the healthcare industry. And I was horrified as to what kind of waste it is as well. Surely there's got to be a big move there in terms of, but that's more complicated, isn't it? I mean, utensils used in surgery. It's a big change in terms of how that's all managed.
Yeah, it's a vexed question. It's a tricky one because, you know, we have this, it's about infection control, you know, and so we have to keep our patients safe and we have to, you know, not spread communicable diseases. And, you know, certainly like in surgery, there's so much waste, but it's so, so very important that you don't introduce infection when you're having an operation. So there's a lot of procedures and protocols around that. But, you know, saying that, there's a whole heap of unnecessary waste generated. And, you know, sometimes you'll see people, you know, they put a gloves on, they use it, they put another set of gloves on for the same patient. We certainly could do a lot there around just being a bit sensible about not overusing the plastics and, you know, using reusable products like we used to do. You know, we used to have things made of metal and gowns made of material, and we'd wash them and then reuse them. Just seems like not that hard a thing to do. And, you know, certainly this is sort of an emerging field for us at DEA. So this is not something that we've kind of really cemented our position on, but we're certainly looking at ways that we can encourage the healthcare system to reduce waste, given that we're getting this sort of emerging understanding of the health impacts of plastics. You know, like we are now seeing, it's just really awful. You know, we're seeing plastics in every organ of the body. We're seeing plastics in placentas. We're seeing atheromas, so the plaques in our arteries that end up, you know, kind of being the seed for the heart attack or the stroke, containing microplastics, and that the risk of having the event is higher if there's plastics in your atheroma. I mean, Jesus, you know, like what a terrible thing this is. And, you know, there's thousands of plastics with names that nobody can ever remember. They haven't been tested. We don't know what they do. And we've got oceans, you know, ocean creatures drowning in plastics. It's, yeah, it's bad. And they're made of coal, oil and gas.
We recently had Dr. Jack Orty on the show this year again, repeat guest, and he spoke about because again, in healthcare, plastic is used to store blood, and through blood infusions, how they discovered how much plastic was actually entering that blood to the extent that patients were tasting it when they were put on an IV drip. Or not IV drip, but on a you know, having a blood transfusion or a, so yeah, it's everywhere, isn't it? Look, there's been a lot of doom and gloom we've been talking about, and it can be quite depressing. It's nice to hear that there's a realization and an intent to do better in the healthcare system. That's fantastic. Let's talk a little bit more generally about, because our health is important. We can't do advocacy work. We can't do anything else if our health is poor. Poor health puts a burden on the rest of our families, puts a burden on our communities, or we feel burdened by others. So it's an important area. When we talk about advocating to do better, I'm going to refer to a quote from yourself as part of the You Are Very Last Contributor, as part of the wrap up. And it's something that's always resonated with me, but your quote was, and it was quite powerful. In fact, I urge a lot of our listeners, if you haven't, go back to season 2, episode 50. It was a final episode of season 2. And your quote is, "If I know and I see it and I don't do anything about it, I'm a monster." And that's all about if you're in a position to make a contribution. If you can control things, and if you can, then if you're in a position to do good, you're obligated to do so. That's always been my mantra as well. So, kind of going on that theme, you know, has your mantra changed a little bit in those 3 years? What would you suggest as to our listeners in terms of, look, for those that can, those are healthy, those are able, how should we be advocating for change?
Well, thank you, Ben. Just thank you for that compliment then. That's just so lovely. You know, I fundamentally believe that we are alive at this pivotal moment in human history, and that we owe it to the people who came before us, all the sacrifices that have been made by humans for centuries. And we owe it to the people that we hope will come after us to do everything we can. Some of us have the capacity to do more than others. You know, I'm very lucky because I have great capacity. You know, like I have this amazing job with this amazing organisation that advocates to do good things and, you know, use my voice. But I do think everybody can do something, and it's a matter of trying to figure out what that something is and seeing that it's worth it. You know, because I think, you know, this stuff is overwhelming and terrifying and hard. And, you know, for us, each little individual, you can just think, well, you know, what's the point? I'm just one little person in this 8 billion humans. But all those little things add up, all those little somethings. And so it's a matter of saying, okay, what's my something? I'm going to have a go. I'm going to do it. So, you know, like we all have the something of, you know, voting for our climate. Like we all have the something of when we're in the ballot box thinking about the climate policies of the different parties and voting with your, with, you know, the health of the planet, meaning also the health of you and your children and your children's children and your whole community, putting that front. But, you know, there's other things we can do, you know, like what we eat is a climate action. Or advocacy within your own sphere. You know, maybe it's saying to your council, stop letting people paint their roofs black, because like all those black roofs means a really hot suburb. Or, you know, protecting trees or gardening. Gardening's a climate action. So I don't think my mantra's changed. I think that, you know, if your eyes are open and you're looking and you're not acting, it's like, what are you doing? You know, but I do understand that it's scary and hard. And so I just urge people who are listening to think, all right, what's that thing that really gets to me the most? What's the bit that just irritates the nuts out of me? And have a bit of a crack. And, you know, trying itself is worth it. You know, you might succeed and be amazing. You might succeed partially, but that's still a success. And every time you do something, you get a bit better at it. So, you know, we learn as we go. And, you know, who knows where you might end up. And just the world's a scary place, but we have to try. That's my thing.
I think that's the best way anyone can ever wrap up a podcast yarn, a chat. Kate, thank you so much. Your passion, we love having your passion on the show. Your aptitude in terms of, you know, your outlook, it's inspiring to all of us. It gives us hope. You know, we use the term grounded hope. We got that from Sally Gillespie, and that's important. You know, these kind of chats give us a buzz. You know, when you look around us, not much is happening, but you know, these kind of chats allow us to finish off. Great podcast. I'm putting my phone down and I'm going to go out and do some good. So thank you so much, Kate. It's been an absolute privilege to have you back on the show. Hopefully not another 3 years before we have you back on, but thank you so much for everything you do in our general global community. It's really inspiring, and thank you so much for your time and to come on the show today.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Emma. Thank you very much for inviting me along. And, you know, go the Lentil Intervention, all the good work that you do as well, hey?
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.